Welcome to Ride the Omnibus, the podcast that takes you on a journey through pop culture history. Each week, our panel of professional nerds reviews creative works, both ancient or oldish and new. Hosted by myself, Ariel Baska, our merry band of creators shares what makes their wheels go round. Come ride the omnibus with us. With me today are Ellen Babcock.
Hi, Ellen Babcock here. I'm here because I have a background in physics. I'm a physics teacher. I studied that in college, and I've studied watching every nerdy thing I can get my little visual mitts on and then chew it up, and I'm ready to give it back.
All right. And Maria Johnson.
Hi, I'm Maria Johnson. I've got a background in all things nerdy. And currently teach chemistry in high school. And I'm thrilled to be here.
Yay! We are discussing a specific film from 2009, Agora, starring Rachel Weisz as Hypatia of Alexandria, a famous woman who was one of the foremost mathematicians and philosophers of her time. So what I'd like to do first, before we get started, though, since I haven't seen you guys physically in a very long time, can you take a minute to kind of tell me how you're actually doing with the pandemic situation with everything that's going on right now? Like, how are things in New York, Maria?
Right now, it's a fabulous sunny day. Breeze right off of Lake Cayuga. I'm just north of Ithaca, Cornell University. And the pandemic, I'm actually in a county where there's only two infected individuals in the county, and their tracking is phenomenal online, which is excellent. And that's how New York is.
And the online teaching experience, working from home and...
I actually kind of very much enjoy it. I look at the pandemic as a chance that we can kind of rethink the whole education system. So, not for the little ones. I teach higher, you know, older kids that can stay at home and can use technology. So, and so much of their day is really wasted between bell ringings and walking to class and distractions by other students in the class. So I think it is a lot more efficient way to teach material to older students. So I'm actually enjoying it very much.
Ellen?
Yeah, I'm enjoying the teaching aspect as well. The getting ready for it is perhaps, I tended in the classroom, I tended to be very seat of the pants and just kind of, I knew what I wanted to do and just kind of threw things out at them. So this is much more preparation than I normally do, because you actually do have to be prepared. But with that said, once we're actually in class, you know, I provide them with a module. It's basically just a hyperdoc with a bunch of stuff for them to do. And that goes to them separately. And then we either talk about a few things from what they're going to study throughout the week, or we just talk to each other and we get to reconnect, because that's what they miss. They miss being with all the kids that they had normally been with. And I just wish, but they are very quiet, right? So you still have to like really work to get them to actually talk, which is tough. But then once they do, those three or four kids that used to talk, they do talk a lot, but it's fun. And I also, during this time, I've been embracing some anime and some other things. And so I tend to lead and some Minecrafting. When I say some, I mean a lot. So I open up, I like have the relaxing Minecraft music playing for 30 minutes in the classroom before class starts. And then I go through, I queue up several different things on YouTube for them. Either I share like the opener of the anime I'm currently watching or some other stuff to get them hyped up a little bit. And then it's fun. And So I try to hook them in, and then I say whatever it is I'm going to say, and then I talk for too long, and then we have a brief dance party at the end, and then we're done. So that part is great. I know it sounds crazy, but I wish we had more time. They only give us 45 minutes a class, right?
And we're We totally need more time.
Totally need more time. We're used to 90 minutes two or three times a week, and we get 45 minutes once. So that's a little bit tricky, but yeah. So then I just post the recordings for all the classes so that all the kids, they could just like watch it, and they could have, what, 3 hours of content that they could watch if they chose to. And it's like being there. Anyway,
well, I try to stress that they can fast forward too. They can get to the part that they don't remember or they didn't understand. So
good point.
More efficient use of their time, even though they're maybe watching it again.
Yep. That's true. I moderately had assumed, meaning since I didn't say it to them at all, I assumed that they were doing that. But as far as where I am, physically during this, it's not as infection-free as upstate New York seems to be, but it's not bad. I'm in mid-state Virginia, and yeah, it's fine. I mean, I was a homebody anyway, so I'm perfectly happy being home. Yeah. You know, I'm not bored in my house, and I'm in my house having a pretty decent time. So I'm good with that, except for the worrying about everything part. But other than that, and then just watching things happen, but that's not what this podcast is about. So we're not. See how I brought that back around full circle?
Yeah, that's great.
Pun intended.
The perfect circle. Yeah. So, taking it around to the film that we watched in preparation for today, as I mentioned, the film is Agora. You may notice that I pronounce it Agora, where a lot of people in the film pronounce it Agora. Agora is a Greek word. It literally means marketplace or forum, where you conduct all your business, you do all your worship, etc. We get the word agoraphobia from it. I really, really can't stress enough that as a former classics major and a Latin teacher, it cannot be beaten out of me to use the Greek pronunciation. I'm sorry. But this film was directed by Alejandro Amenábar, who is known for Open Your Eyes, a film that was turned into Vanilla Sky by Hollywood. His most famous film that he directed and wrote was The Others. Sad news about the budget. It cost $70 million to make and had a worldwide gross of just $39.5 million. I find it interesting that a film that's entirely about a figure that I consider to be one of the foremost female figures that a lot of history has neglected, Roger Ebert titled his review, Christians 1, Library 0. Oh. But anyway. We'll talk more about the actual historical figure of Hypatia later, but for right now, I just want to note that she's mostly known for being a gifted philosopher in predominantly male spaces, expressing ideas that were usually expressed by men and exerting authority that was usually reserved by men. She's used as a feminist icon. She's been called a witch, a martyr, force for peace and good government. But the problem is, all the evidence we have of Hypatia's life is almost entirely written by men, and we only have stories that appealed to male authors about her life. So all of the sources that this film is based on really are from men who didn't necessarily have an understanding of the conflicts that were necessary for a woman to have the position that she had in knowledge and science at the time. So that's something I hope we can talk about a little later. So, first impressions, when you guys saw the crawl across the screen. So the film opens with a scene of the Earth that says, in the 4th century, the Library of Alexandria and the Lighthouse of Alexandria are these wonders of the pagan world. And there's the Jewish faith and recently legalized Christianity that come along. Dum dum dum. What did you guys think of when you first saw that?
Whenever you see something that you know is about science and then they throw religions in there, you know that something's going to hit the fan, right?
And they didn't just throw one religion in.
They put in pretty much
all of it.
Like yeah, pretty much all
of, yeah. all of them together.
Yeah, because you've got three religions in there.
Yeah. I was completely entranced with the globe in the background. I loved the space shots. And to start with that space shot, I was already in, and it was juxtaposed to talking about the ancient world and, you know, the Earth in the background. I thought it was an impressive way to start.
Well, and I really appreciate that that globe gets used again and again with different shots as transitions throughout the film in moments that you wouldn't necessarily expect, constantly tying the film back to the science concepts that are really at the heart of who she was.
Having it start with us out in space, for me, what it actually did was it said, oh, this is going to be about perspective. And it really was, because you're talking about the context of what's going on historically was in the words on the screen, but we were seeing Earth from space, which was very unexpected. So it's like, aha. And she's her mind is out in space looking back at the planets and trying to figure out what's going on. And then that just keeps coming back up. They keep leaving and then coming back and going back into orbit and coming back to the Earth, because it's always about this. What is constant? What is changing? What is truth? What is perspective? How do we see truth through the lens of our perspective? And how can we change that perspective by asking questions?
And so, the fact that she's constantly depicted as looking up at the sky throughout the film, whether people are talking to her or not, she's not necessarily paying attention.
Or sometimes instead of talking to people at all. You know, it's funny, too, because... millions of years ago, 14, when I was first starting to teach or to learn how to teach, when I did my very first lessons ever that I would take out to do in mini, practice things in high schools. And it was always about gravitation and circular motion. And my presentation would start with sitting around the fire. We ate protein. We got bulked up on our calories and on our brain growth. And so we had a moment, and then they're poking in the fire, but then somebody leans back and looks up and they look into the night sky. And that's when they really became human and start thinking. And it's very Descartes. They actually look, they're like, what is that? What am I? Who am I? What's going on? And then you really get into it. So for her, later on when she says put out the fire so that she can see the sky well, when she's right on the verge of making some of her big breakthroughs, and that's it, to get that perspective. And in space, the sun isn't, unless you're looking directly, you can see a lot more. On the Earth, we're kind of, trapped. Boy, there's too much. There's so much to say about this. One could go on forever.
Well, maybe we better go on to the next sequence, which has her actually in the space of the Library of Alexandria. And the first thing we see is Hypatia dropping the handkerchief, which will become significant later. And she's in the middle of an astronomy/physics lesson about gravity and how it might work. And at the same time, there's a religious ceremony going on outside the library to the Egyptian gods, which is an example of the syncretism that they had in the Greco-Roman world, where you just add all of the gods together and you worship literally every single god available. Eddie Izzard had a whole routine about Jeff, the god of biscuits. You just worship anything that's out there. And at the same time, you've got the slave who's observing Orestes hitting on Hypatia. And apparently she rejects him because then she's talking with her father about how she's rejected him and told him to study music instead. Meanwhile, Davis, the slave, is giving her longing looks, etc. So, looking at the way that this sort of sets up the soap opera of the film, I found that in this sequence, I was actually very annoyed the first time I saw this film. I was like, okay, we're dealing with one of the greatest minds in history, and she's being perceived as a sex object. And I got very irritated very quickly with this film, which isn't quite fair given what happens later, but I just wondered if you guys had the same reaction, if you had different reactions to this sequence.
I thought she could have done so much more with it. I was a little disappointed because she was known for being this amazing philosopher, and the point was a little lax, just that, you know, it's falling vertical and, oh, our feet were at the center, and her speech of trying to inspire her students, I thought was not as impactful as it could have been. And I found that actually throughout the film when she talked in front of other elders and stuff, I was like, wow, the writers could have made her more powerful than they did. But as you, maybe it's because of the source. I mean, I'm just learning from you that the sources were just from stories written by men, but I guess to appeal to men, but I guess I, in my head, always had her being a more powerful speaker than they made her out to be in the film.
Mm-hmm. Or were they trying to depict what would happen to, or how would a woman speak at that time? Because very clearly, I mean, when the father's talking about her, you know, and calls her the most brilliant philosopher I have, right, you know, had the pleasure to know, and then the other one says, you know, but her sad, except for her sad condition.
Sad condition, yeah.
And her sad condition is being a woman. Yeah. Right? So she probably learned early on that maybe if she's alone with her father, she can be much more herself. But in other environments, with other groups of people, she has to be a bit more circumspect, more circles, with what she's saying. And in fact, the fact that she relaxes enough to speak the way that she does with her students, whom she calls her brothers at one point,
right,
leads to some trouble, you know? So perhaps it's even that, well, not even then, but especially then, because what did they say? If she got married, she wouldn't even have the right to think.
Right. She would have absolutely no academic freedom, no right to teach, et cetera. The other thing I wanted to say, though, is the fake profundity aspect. I definitely have issues with that throughout this film. And I always thought it was the fault of the writers, that the writers don't have enough confidence in the audience to really follow actual science.
Yeah, that's a possibility. Because I caught that, and I should have wrapped that back around, because that is where your question started. And I will be honest, as I was watching it for the first 45 minutes or so, because I found the lessons ever so slightly lame, and I had to keep reminding, well, she doesn't really know what's happening. She doesn't actually know, because they don't. They talked about weightiness or heaviness, but they don't know what gravity is at all. To have a concept of a field force is just beyond them completely. But I remember in those first 45 minutes, I mean, if it had not been an assignment, I would have clicked it. I would have stopped watching, because I'm like, you know, because I, you know, I do that. I'm not a purist. I don't see every movie all the way through. And I've only walked out on one movie, Tank Girl, but it was bad. I usually don't walk out of a movie in a theater, because by then I've made some sort of a commitment. But if I'm watching, you know, if I'm streaming something, so because of that, it was a bit weak. It was a bit painful. And
so the soap opera elements in there, in terms of her interactions with the Resties, like,
yeah, it was that was all. But it was important. I mean, for the story that they were telling and where they were going with it, they had to do all that stuff. Otherwise, you wouldn't see the little bits in there. And actually, again, well, I'll save it for later, but there's another scene. They do. They have to continually have him coming after her.
Yeah.
Stalking in the stacks and stalking other places and making the plays that usually work. He's got a playbook. It's the, you know, guys in the 400s AD playbook. This has worked so far. Why isn't it working? Oh, it's not me. It's you. So there we go. But no, so yeah, it was disappointing, but I didn't know. I had the luxury of not knowing the full story. I decided to watch it, you know, only with the information that you had given me, Ariel. Mm-hmm. Going into it, I decided not to do any research before, so I didn't have preconceived notions specifically. And I am sad to say I did not know. I knew the name Hypatia. I did not know specifics at all. And therefore, I was, I think that possibly that made those aspects not as hard for me to watch. Hmm. But the physics at some times was a little hard to watch because, you know, I mean, the handkerchief fell as if surface area and drag had nothing to do with its motion whatsoever. A handkerchief is not going to fall like that unless there was a rock sewn into the corner of it. But we won't talk about that. And I'm sure it probably was because they probably tried to have it fall and it wasn't going to fall. And sorry.
No, that's a good point.
So, because it wouldn't. That demo, you have piece of paper crumpled up and a flat piece of paper to show that it's not the mass that's the problem, it's the surface area and the equation for drag. But if you take that out and then you crumple the other one and then they both fall straight down. But that now I'm going to have to go get a nice handkerchief.
I actually didn't think the handkerchief, the second time she dropped the handkerchief, I didn't think it fell that straight down. That's why I didn't think it was a demonstration, an impressive demonstration, except for I can see why they did that because of the future with the handkerchiefs.
All right.
Yeah.
So the next sequence has the Christians versus the pagans, and you get these shouting matches between Ammonius, who's one of the Parabolani, who we now know are soldiers of Christ, and the pagans, who are yelling things like, "We just fed you to the lions." And Ammonius's comeback is, "Yeah, well, if my God is the true God, I can walk across this fire and I shall suffer no harm." And so he crosses the fire, and the pagan gets dragged and thrown in to burn. And immediately after this, we have the father questioning all of the slaves because he finds a cross somewhere in the house, and he's very concerned because the Christians just burned someone in the Agora, and as a result, Davis, the slave, steps forward and says, "Whip me, punish me instead of the girl who's actually a Christian," and so this is sort of the beginning of where the conflicts between all of the different religions come in. Did the way the religions were depicted surprise you at all between
not
the pagans and the Christians?
No, not for me. It didn't surprise me.
Well, yeah, I don't know about surprising, but it made it clear that ignorance rules the day. It just made that very clear of just as when Davis was talking to the slaves after he was whipped, and the guy's like, "Well, why didn't he get burnt? That must be, you know, if he didn't get burnt, he could walk through fire." It just showed how the ignorance led, science ignorant led to a false belief.
Right.
That, now, yeah.
They didn't give background on it. So would he have practiced? What was going on? Did he happen to have, or was it possibly that he had really nasty, wet clothing that was more resistant to burn instead of the nice, fine linens and wools of the,
yeah,
of the other guy?
There was definitely a difference in clothing, but just being able to walk across it. not being pushed down.
Exactly. It looks like he knew what was going on. He looked as if he had done it before.
I did not trust Ammonius from that moment forward.
Right.
Because I thought charlatan right off the bat. The movie never lets you know, because he gives to the poor and he makes Davis here. This is what it feels like to be Christian. You give to the poor, and he gives away all of his master's bread. But so you kind of like Ammonius then, but then he's so fine with the killing and the Parabolani, the order of monks. Is that how you say it?
Mm-hmm.
And then everything he does there makes you hate him. So
right. Yeah. Well, honestly, when I saw seeing the scenes underneath with giving out the bread to the poor. Yeah, absolutely. It makes the people doing it feel good. But did the hierarchy, did those people know? Because I have it written down right here about seeing a miracle. You can see a miracle if you choose to.
Right.
And he said, you want to see a miracle, but giving bread for faith is calculated bribery to build numbers.
Full stomachs
carry swords in come with you. And that's, what is it? It feels good, but it's not, I mean, I don't think that giving or was at that time, was giving to the poor unique to Christianity? Did they just figure out the marketing ploy that would work really well to build numbers? I mean,
Romans did that too.
Right.
Yeah, I thought
okay.
So.
Right. Okay. Good. So they'd.
I mean, Julius Caesar was a consummate politician because he was so good at giving poor people bread and circuses as they wanted.
Exactly. That's right. Yeah. So it's all okay if you don't then arm the followers and send them out and say it. It always comes down to this way is beautiful and it's the only way.
So after this scene that happens mostly in the Agora, Hypatia comes in to put salve on Davis's back while he's in his slave quarters, and she finds that he has a model of Ptolemy's system, the sun and, as she calls them, the five wanderers with their epicycles. And he says, I believe that our eyes deceive us. So the next day, she's introducing the Ptolemy model and showing it off to everybody. Orestes looks a little cheesed off that she's treating Davis as the class pet, and so he calls the model kind of whimsical. And then Synesius makes it into an attack. Hypatia reminds them of Euclid's first rule, aren't we all equal? Now, for a woman in this particular century to say that she is equal to a man and that they are her brothers and they are her equals, even though she is their teacher, this is not something that in any of the faiths that were popular at the time was embraced and accepted. And I find it very interesting that she's leading the charge in terms of saying we are all equal rather than letting someone else put that title on her, that she's very confident at this stage in the movie as to her status. So I just wondered what you guys thought of that.
She kind of has to do that, though, because if she tried, this is my opinion, one, she didn't take credit for it. She said, Euclid's, what is Euclid's law? First law or first rule, what is Euclid's first rule? And made the students tell her what it was. So then she interpreted it. But if she doesn't interpret herself as with them, if she kept herself above them, she wouldn't have as much loyalty, and there'd be more people don't like to be below. There'd be more reason for them to knock her off. So I think politically she was smart that way. And I think deep down she really didn't want people to fight because she's like, this is a ridiculous thing to fight about.
I actually saw it a little bit differently from both of you. I also didn't hear her say equal. I heard her say similar, because Euclid's Law is about two things that are similar to each other, are similar to one thing, are similar to each other. And it might have been equal, but
two things equal to the third.
Yeah,
then
to
they're
the third.
All equal.
Right. So, well, but it's geometry. So similar means equal, right? But I think that she was simply talk, because then she follows it with, we have more in common. There's more that connects us than divides us. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that she was trying to say that she was politically or in any way equal to them. I think that she had such purity of thought. I mean, all she cared about was thinking and figuring stuff out. And in there, there's I mean, later on, if we're jumping around a little bit somewhere, yeah. One of them says, it's like your faith, you believe in your faith and it doesn't allow you to question your beliefs. Mine must, the way I right. feel about everything, I must question things. Mm-hmm. And I had in here also that how do you change perspective? You do it by asking questions. Right. And that's what it says. Synesius says, you don't question what you believe. You cannot, she says to him, you can't. And she must. So that's where their similarity falls apart as soon as Christianity comes in, because they say, if you're saying the heavens aren't perfect, if you criticize the heavens, then you're criticizing my God.
Multiple times.
Multiple times.
Who
are you to do
God?
That? Who are you to try to understand God? How it works? Don't even think mm-hmm. about how it works.
Yeah, it's beyond your comprehension. You're just, yeah.
Right? Those things are for God to understand, not for us to understand. And all she wants is to understand. Mm-hmm. And she's
who are
such
you to
a,
find a vaccine? Yeah.
she's such a true and pure empiricist, and she's only about thought, philosophy, and doesn't even know to call it physics, and that's all she cares about. And you know, so that's how we can tell ourselves that it was a happy ending. Because also she goes and talks about she and the brothers in intellect, as it were, being equal to each other. But then at the very end, even though the entire scene is based upon Davis's beautiful model, she then says, "Brawling is for slaves and riffraff."
Yeah, and that
and of course that sets him off to go and seek out Ammonius.
Yeah,
And sort of drives him into the arms of the Christian Church. Unfortunately,
yeah. Right? Because even with
and
all of her,
yeah.
even with her. Apparently open mind, she's still coming from a place of privilege. Mm-hmm. She was able to take a bath whenever she wanted to. She was clean clothes and that was it. And the order, I mean, it was very clear. It was man, woman, slave.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously with an enormous gap between man and woman, but still man, woman, slave.
But really, she couldn't dry herself. Really? That was odd.
She's
just standing there bored out of her mind while multiple people dry her off. Yeah. I mean, I appreciate the nude, but, you know.
Well, at the time that this is set, there's a real problem with the way that slavery is evolving in the empire at this point. And there's not as much of the manumission that will happen later, where masters set their slaves free. And it's very much expected for a beautiful lady like Hypatia to have all of these servants.
It's very sadly the embodiment of the phrase, it was a different time.
It was.
I mean, because you knew what you didn't know and you knew what you were curious about. And then there were things that didn't even come on the radar for you to be curious about.
Mm-hmm.
You might free a slave at the right moment, like later on when she frees Davis, but she never frees the other guy whose name I don't remember.
Aspasia,
the one who actually kind of like figured everything out.
Yeah.
Right?
Like he never gets cited in the
textbooks. That's what I was going to say. He doesn't get a cred in the book when she writes her paper. Oh, doesn't write her paper. Sorry. But they didn't even recognize that. And to make the riffraff, the slave and riffraff comment right after having praised him and saying clearly one person in here has been paying attention.
Right.
And yet, but not actually giving him credit that he can own. And it's like, oh, because that didn't cause a shift for her. She questioned things, but the only thing that she's interested in is celestial mechanics. That's the only thing that she's actually interested
in. And it's not going to lead her to stop disparaging other classes and so forth.
And that's what causes the trouble. She's so focused on philosophy and celestial mechanics that she doesn't see the politics and misogyny swirling around her. Mm-hmm. She's clueless, beautifully clueless, but clueless. Yeah. Plus she never played the game, so she didn't get it. But she's as guilty in her own way as the others. They hold the tenets of the religion too close. No, because she holds science a little bit too close. You have to back up a little bit to see the whole picture. I mean, she was right about the things she was saying, but there was stuff that she wasn't thinking about because she was so focused.
I'll give you that, but I mean, the masses in this movie were driven by ignorance and greed and politics, and she was clueless to that. That's why I wouldn't say she's as guilty. She being clueless to it, but she didn't have this
culpability
need to shove her philosophy down everyone's throats, and she didn't have this need to slaughter people because they weren't interested in the same stuff she was.
Right.
I've got something else in here, and actually it's funny, and I'm not trying to say she's blinded by the brightness of her own mind. We all have blind spots. Some do harm through action, and some allow harm to be done through inaction. And we're seeing this now, right? With the whole new awareness things about stuff going on in our world. We see it, but if you mean just because you don't take part in the oppression doesn't mean that you're innocent just because you're busy doing something else. If you don't do something, but she wasn't even able to recognize, I mean, it was 400. So it was like seriously a different time. But she watched slaves getting beaten and didn't think that there was anything really. She did. It was enough wrong that she went to help him and put the salve on his back, but not enough to say you shouldn't be doing this in the first place. And these people shouldn't be owned. So it's interesting. So it's a combination of the two. I mean, yes, I still think her mind is absolutely beautiful, but she lived sadly within the constraints of her time.
Yeah. So Davis, of course, is reacting to the way that she is responding to both him and his class. And as we were talking about before, he goes and seeks out Ammonius, who takes him to church where he hears the Beatitudes. And Ammonius tells him to give away his master's bread. And in exchange, Ammonius will teach Davis how to pray. And then you get the embarrassing scenes for Orestes. They're going to a play at the library, and the audience is clapping using their special slapsticks. This is actually where the word slapstick comes from. It's just a wooden board with two pieces. And during the costume change, Orestes gets right on up there and publicly declares his love for Hypatia, says he studied music just as she asked him to, and plays this bagpipe-like reeded instrument. So he gives it to her in public.
The music was horrid.
Yeah.
The music was horrid. I was like, are they going to start laughing? But they clapped for him.
Well, no, that was the music. I mean, that was
what it was supposed
but
to sound
that's
like?
What it actually is supposed to sound like. That's called the aulos, which is an important Greek instrument, and that is actually what it is supposed to sound like.
Oh my God.
Like a bagpipe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Because you got the one note that I guess keeps you in tune with the other note, is my guess.
Yep.
You have the one bass and then you go up and down from it. So I'm
showing my...
It works great in an amphitheater too. You know, it's an open space instrument, I would say. But Yeah, no, it's and but not everybody likes, you know, that sound. So no. you're good with that. But I could recognize the harmonies within it and the antagonistic assonance and dissonance going on, which sounds like them anyway.
Yeah. So, I actually have a friend who offers workshops on how to play that instrument.
Oh my god.
Every year.
I'm embarrassed.
She teaches it over the summer.
I would think it would hurt. Do they build up calluses inside their cheeks?
I mean, my father.
Both holes at once.
My father was a reed player, and
that's like the thing.
You have to have the right embouchure, that's for sure. But
listen to these words.
What?
Is that mouth geometry?
Yeah.
Okay.
Totally. That's all
there
it is.
There you go.
That's all it is.
Okay. That makes sense.
Speaking of mouth geometry, one of my favorite lines in the movie was in the bathhouse, where they were talking about Ammonius. It was earlier on, and one of the older elder men, this was before they talked about marrying off Hypatia, he's like, if I were to like a banana instead of a fish,
oh, yeah.
I would be all over. I was just like,
I would be all over Orestes.
Yeah. I was like, what an awesome way. And it was just so open, and it was no big deal. Something that obsesses our culture.
Yeah.
You know, our culture just has to talk about that.
Yeah.
It just rolled right off his tongue.
And that's literally the beginning of this next scene. And I love that line, too, because it does show the openness about sexuality that you have in the Greco-Roman world, even at this time. Particularly from the pagans. The Christians are not so free with the bisexuality thing as the pagans are. But that language actually echoes a lot of writings from different poets of the first century AD. So,
no, I love that line. I thought it was awesome.
Yeah. And I think there's a similar line in Spartacus as well that Sir Laurence Olivier gives.
Oysters and scallops or something
like that.
I was going to say the banana and the fig, it's very obvious what they're talking about. The scallop and the oyster leaves me a little bit lacking.
Yeah.
It's
obvious what he means.
It's almost like they had two reasons to edit it out of a couple of versions of the movie. One is because some people didn't want to share that, and some people just like, it's not very clear. I mean, we know what he's saying, but who's the oyster? Who's the scallop, right?
Yeah.
So it's like, let's play scallops and oysters. You know, it's like playing bears or something. I don't know. Mm-hmm. It's good. And yeah, it is leading right towards this. So he puts himself out there, so to speak, and plays his song for her. And I was so embarrassed for him.
But then I thought the music was bad.
No, he actually plays it at a superb level for...
Didn't they all do the perspective thing with that too? Didn't they come out of the city and hear the music coming and then come back in? Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was pretty good.
Yeah, and I didn't know if that was meant to portray how enormously loud he was. Or, I mean, it almost seems parodic the way that it zooms out. But
It could be. He's sending his message out.
To the universe.
To the universe, exactly. And because it fell on her deaf ears.
And then we have the father and friends. As we said, we hear the banana and fig comment, and they're at dinner. Okay, I gotta say, Latin teacher note. They are gathered together for dinner with the correct number of tables together, but they're in the atrium instead of the triclinium, which means that they've got a circle above their heads, which would only be in the entrance hall, not in where you eat. And this was a historical inaccuracy that drove me kind of crazy, and it wouldn't drive anyone else crazy.
No.
And I know it's just because they wanted another circle in the shot. So,
but was it a circle?
Yeah.
Because if you looked at an angle, it becomes an eclipse.
Yeah, no.
Where they, no. they rethink the whole thing. The Oculus was a split circle, but then they started filming it from an angle early on.
I know. Eventually they do that, but in this scene, it's still...
I am so sorry that that bothered you. I had no clue.
Clueless.
No, it's okay. I mean, it's not terribly horrible. It's just like... No.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say they didn't have the right number of feathers available. But you know.
No, I mean, it should be like a fully walled room, no windows, just a lot of frescoes and, you know, maybe people boinking in those frescoes.
Is that what dining al fresco actually
means?
No, I know. Dining with the frescoes.
Yeah, no. No, that is not what that
means. The bananas and the pig.
The bananas and the banana and the tailpipe.
Oh, good Lord. Okay. Woo! But anyway,
hey.
So in this sequence, the whole conversation revolves around, like, I'd want some of that Orestes if I were Hypatia. And you, as her father, should make her marry him. And the father is like, nope, she'd have no freedom to teach. She's one of the best minds in the world. And his friend says, yeah, but don't forget her sad condition. She is still a woman.
When she's listening, she's acting like a small child when she's listening to that.
Yeah, we did. You can't get away from it. It is... her glaring sadness and truth also that she spends a lot of time avoiding.
Mm-hmm.
And then she forgets sometimes, I swear, because when she says we're brothers, that's what also gets me, because it's like you just don't even think of yourself as anything except a thinker.
And then in the next sequence, so she announces that she's giving back a gift to Orestes. And so she hands him... the handkerchief with her menstrual blood. She says, I find that there's little harmony or beauty in that. I would assume you agree with that. And he walks out. Now, this particular scene is the most talked about anecdote from Hypatia's life. And everybody who's seen this movie wants to talk about this scene. So I want to know what you guys thought of this presentation of the blood of her cycle to this suitor.
I'm going to jump in there super quick and say that she was contradicting herself when she said it was not harmonious and it was the blood of her cycle. It's a circle.
Yeah,
I mean,
come on, man.
Beautiful about that.
Yeah.
But they knew nothing. They didn't know anything at that time.
But we don't even really know what she actually said. We just know that some dude wrote down that she did this. So I just want to remind the listeners that that's all we know. Maria?
Right, and that was the other question. Is there anything that says that happened? But Maria,
there is.
What are your thoughts?
I was hoping... that she was faking it. And when Davis was looking, obviously he was thrilled because he's thinking his wish was granted, his prayer was granted, and now he's going to believe in Jesus Christ because...
Yeah.
But I was really hoping that she just...
Now I really have to put something on my cut.
To me, it's a duality. Because I'm at first I'm like, hopefully she just cut herself and is doing this. And then part of me's going... wow, what a great way to break up with someone, you know?
Unnecessary is almost what I thought it was. But you said that there is some historical evidence that something like this happened?
Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
This is a very popular anecdote from the time. Now, I have several Latin teacher friends who think of this as her being so uncouth that they can no longer get behind Hypatia in this film because she just appears to be such a barbarian and so very unladylike for some reason, which also strikes me as interesting. Because if you're thinking about one of the greatest minds and you're rejecting her for being unladylike and uncouth, I think that's an issue. I like to think of her as being extremely rebellious and punk when she does this, personally.
And with it being such a sexually open culture, mm-hmm. what was the idea when a woman was menstruating at the time?
Lot of stigma against women at this time. Like, you have to remember that there are no, like, tampons. And women were supposed to remain hidden indoors during these times, etc. So her even flaunting the fact that she was having her period at that moment is considered extremely rebellious.
Right. It was the connection. I didn't quite see. I mean, how does somebody think of doing that? It's like,
I think she was just desperate to get him to stop going after her, pursuing me. But ultimately, the movie depicts them as friends.
Yeah.
I mean, he's still pining
for
her.
Right, I know. He doesn't.
But ultimately, he's friends with her. What is it? Jump ahead like 11 years? I can't remember how many years.
They just say several years.
Yeah,
I think. They
a number of years.
Yeah, so they obviously maintain a very close friendship, actually.
Yeah. Interesting.
So in that next sequence, we have Olympias demanding everyone's presence as the pagans are demanding that everyone attack against the Christians. And Hypatia steps in, telling everyone, please stop. I don't want murder here. And of course, this is the scene where her father doesn't back her up. Her father is consulted for his opinion, and he's like, this insult must be answered. So the pagans go out. They see the Christians mocking the pagan statues in the Agora. The pagans attack. Christians are hostages. And Hypatia insists that she's going to go to the prisons with them as a hostage if they are treated as such. And then that prompts Orestes to swear he'll defend all of his brothers. And the old men look down and they're like, oh my God, when were there so many Christians? I guess we got to negotiate. And Hypatia.
That was a good line. That was a very good line.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
just coming out of the woodwork. They're just everywhere. Yeah.
Because they've been feeding them.
And then we have the whole siege of the Library of Alexandria that happens over a period of days. But how did you guys react to the way that this conflict starts?
Just so pointless. It was just so pointless. Answering an insult.
Yeah.
Specifically, like, they burned one of us, so now we're going to go and get them. It's always the tit for tat thing, the one-upsmanship and having to go in. And it's the belligerent version of having the last word, having the last kill.
Right.
And totally unnecessary. And to have so many of the people in the class, so many of the philosophers go out and want to do it too. I just don't get it.
Isn't that the whole mob mentality, though?
It is the whole mob mentality. And actually, Orestes even says it later. I think I took a picture of it almost to share. It's like, I thought we were beyond this.
Yeah.
You know, and people are always thinking that. I mean, it was kind of like us being in our bubble. They were in their bubble in that classroom. And then all of a sudden they turned and saw the real world. It's like, oh, people are thinking this way. Look at all this division. People can't just go for truth. And so then they started saying, oh, let's be political and happy and just all go get baptized. And then we'll all do that. But that was a little bit later. But still, I thought I always get angry at scenes like that. Especially because there was a library at the center of it, you know, and I.
And it's not just any library.
Oh, I know. It is the remnants of the library.
I'm going to take a minute to just say I have actually wept over the loss of this library myself. I do not exaggerate when I say that. As a Latin major, spending a lot of time researching things, And knowing all of the great works that were lost when the Library of Alexandria burned the second time. The first time it was destroyed, we actually get a reference to that at a later point in the film during this siege, where an old man talks about Aristarchus's theories and how they were lost in the first destruction of the Library of Alexandria. And this second form of the Library of Alexandria is the one that really contained a huge corpus of knowledge. There are dictionaries to languages that we will never know that just disappeared in the smoke. Great works of literature by women that, again, are fragments, if there's anything at all left. When it comes to the ancient world, what we have represents only about 9% of what there was. So for me, studying the classical world, like, I'm always thinking about what we don't know and how much we're constantly inventing because of that loss. So anyway, that's my digression about the Library of Alexandria and why I am so sad that it burned here. And this scene really is cause for me to cry. Probably not as much as I cry at the end, but I definitely...
No, it upsets me, the projectile paths of the scrolls going. I actually had to fast forward through a lot of it. It was too much for me. It gets me very, very angry when there's wanton destruction of knowledge by people who are having fun while they do it.
The saddest of it all is we can't look back and go, that's the way it used to be. We can't do that because it's the way it still is.
Yeah.
Right? So, it is. And even then, I don't know if having the knowledge available longer, we would have actually progressed more. It just seems like it's always these instances where maybe people are actually trying to look at learning of the past and grow from it. And then something happens and they just take it back down to zero.
Yeah, and, we progress in knowledge through the sciences, but as a species, or just as being mankind, we're not progressing at all.
It's actually, I won't mention, it's a thing I'm currently rewatching, and that was actually there. Even if tech changes, man stays the same.
Right.
You know, and it's still always playing one side off against the other, and there's always going to be somebody out there that wants power, and ignorance is much easier to lead than intelligence. Because intelligence, you actually have to make sense to someone that's intelligent to get and thinks to get them on your side. But if you don't need to actually convince them and all you need to do is rile them up, then that's really easy. And so that power prefers ignorance. Now, it's not like they knew exactly that they were going to come in and sack it and loot the place and burn everything. But why didn't they suspect that? Why weren't they already creating an exit plan for that, for those, for the books?
Yeah, it's something I wonder because they're so concerned with just sitting around and having conversations.
I thought they were just surprised by the number of Christians.
Well, yeah, but still over time, they were locked up there for quite a while.
Yeah, remember, they were locked up for at least 2 days.
At least 2 days.
What's shown.
And instead, they give them 5 minutes to grab 6 scrolls. And,
I don't think they even imagined it would end that
way. They didn't. And so that was their arrogance too. Well, and we keep going back to Spartacus, but they were just slaves, you know. Yeah. They were just the Christians. They were just the poor unwashed of the city. Doesn't matter when there's 50,000 of them, it's a lot, or however many, 10,000, as opposed to your 200 people, it makes a difference. Yeah.
And when the prefect arrives, he gives the order from Theodosius I, who is the emperor at the time, who tried to kind of control a lot of the religious issues. But he makes the mistake here of saying that the pagans should be pardoned and freed and vacate the premises, which therefore allows the Christians to do whatever they like.
And they can come in and do what they like with it.
The order that was given is not actually for the Christians to dispose of everything as they like. But, of course, that's what happens.
That's how they interpret it. Yeah.
Yeah. And so you've got Hypatia and everybody trying to grab as much as possible. And she really doesn't want to leave. Davis tries to drag her out and she won't stop. And finally, Orestes drags her. And Hypatia tries to stop Davis as she's going away, thinking he's turning around to die for the gods. Instead, he starts approaching the mob and everybody just sort of runs around him because he's one dude.
Right.
And he ends up joining the Parabolani.
Yeah.
And later, we actually see him destroying his own model that's inside the library and just smashing it against a window. I don't know. What did you guys take from that switching sides?
He drank the Kool-Aid.
Yeah.
He drank the Kool-Aid. And what other options were available to him? Because... Right. Obviously his master's losing.
So then Hypatia's at home, her father's wound is festering, and then Davis suddenly appears out of nowhere, assaults her, but sobs on her shoulders, and finally gives her his sword, which she tosses away, along with his chains, and she tells him he is now free. In an act of manumission that certainly is dramatically interesting, but not too terribly probable, but because usually this had to be officially written up somehow.
Right. I wondered about that. Can you just take off your collar?
No, you can't just take off a chain and woohoo, you're now free.
Yeah, I wondered if... he smashed it because he could have even because the guy had to be really conflicted because he loved her and he learned from her, but he also saw her continually think of him only as a slave.
Right.
And the whole riffraff comment and that whole thing. So smashing it could have just been all that frustration by those years as of patiently waiting for some sort of actual acknowledgement. And that didn't work. Plus, he had probably deceived himself that he was going to end up being part of that life in some way and that that would go on. And now it's gone and he had to smash it. It was his last, it was a tangible connection between him and science. And he had to break it. But then he sees her and then he becomes a puddle anyway and he's ready for her. He's like, go ahead, just kill me. And it's almost like she even says, you're not even worth killing. I'm just going to free you and you can go.
And he took it as she was forgiving him.
Yeah, which because he says later that he was forgiven, but he couldn't forgive her.
But for, what the, well, yeah. For what?
Yeah.
What the hell did she do other well, than that's
always seeing him as a slave? Yeah.
Yeah.
And being a woman and not accepting Christ and all that stuff that, you know, I love it though.
I don't think he was that committed. I really just don't think he had a life. You know, he had to choose between, am I going to be a Christian where I'm a soldier and people listen to me? Yeah, I have to kill. And, or am I going to be a slave to a dying family? And just politically, I think he just jumped ship to go to the winning side. Absolutely the winning side. I didn't see him having the character that I think the movie was trying to show, especially at the end. They're like, oh, he's a good guy. Well, was he? Was he really?
We'll talk more about that at the end.
As we get there. Okay.
So then we have the crawl that tells us that Only Christian and Jewish worship is now allowed in the empire. Most pagans became Christian. The empire split into two parts, which made a lot of people think the end of the world was nigh, something we absolutely know nothing about right now. And the Parabolani now patrol the streets to maintain Christian morality. We have a rebuilt Christian library now for the Library of Alexandria. And we have the introduction of Cyril, a new character on this scene. So he's at the funeral for Theophilus, and we get the idea that we've got a new kid on the block, a new religious power in town. And we see Davis fully integrated into the mob. Christians are stoning Jews at a concert. Orestes is now the governor. And we have a conflict between the Jewish elders and Cyril after this stoning. And Orestes is trying to give the same speech that Hypatia once gave to him. More things unite us than divide us. What did you guys make of this library being used as a Christian space?
Well, a Christian space and barn.
Yeah.
And I just saw it as classically, no pun intended, sad and disused. And
the animals and their waste and hay and food crates and cages. It was sad.
It was very sad. It was
great. You got the building and this is what you do with it.
Precursor to the whole Dark Ages thing.
Yeah. In the ancient world, there is actually a tradition of a lot of pagan spaces being recycled as Christian churches and cathedrals and so forth. And this is particularly irritating to me, given that you have spaces like the Hagia Sophia or Hagia Sophia, which is given a lot of reverence in that it is first a pagan space, then it becomes a Christian cathedral, and today it's a mosque. But in this particular case, it's just extremely depressing.
Well, I think the filmmakers were trying to make Catholics seem just as nasty as they viewed the pagans. And then, okay, so now that the pagans are gone, and then we're going to have the Jews and the Catholics fight. And it was minimizing or making the whole, I think the filmmakers were trying to show their view that religion is ignorance.
Or was this, or was it later when the East and Western churches start splitting?
It was at this point.
Yeah, so I thought, but they're not putting that money. They came into that space. They didn't build that church. They weren't owning that church as their own and making it a beautiful statement to God, like the cathedrals that would happen later on, and churches would happen later on. But they weren't doing that. So it was as if they were continuing to punish the pagans that had built the library and just making sure that it was completely demolished and downgraded constantly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They were treating it like a wife they didn't like.
Now,
but they wore some great outfits.
Yeah, yeah. Those bishops pretty swanky.
Yeah.
And then
there was a top 1% everywhere, right?
That's exactly what I've been thinking. I've been waiting to for the yeah. That there always will be.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the paraphrase. When you say absolute power corrupts absolutely, it means there's always a 1%. That's what that mm-hmm. means. Oh.
And then speaking of the 1%, we have another 1%er who's still hanging out with Hypatia on a boat. We get this beautiful shot of a reconstructed lighthouse of Alexandria, another demolished wonder of the ancient world. But we've got Orestes and Hypatia on a boat performing an experiment. But first, Hypatia is saying to Orestes that Cyril has said that he wants to clean up the city And this worries Hypatia that he specifically set it for Orestes' benefit.
Well, this, of course, as far as the experiment, I loved seeing it because when we're teaching about, usually it's about projectile motion versus the concept of inertia. So this is something that we talk about all the time. And that if you're on the boat, and again, it's perspective that keeps coming back up in this movie. If you are on the boat and looking down, you see it go straight down. If you're standing on the boat, if you're on the shore, you see the parabola and it appears as if it moves to one side, although it's traveling with the boat because you see the two happening at the same time, which is fascinating. And I just love that. So I was thrilled with that. But the part I like the most is I wrote that down, that Hypatia, she's standing there. She says, so I assume it would go right here. And then she stands there, and of course it falls straight down, and she starts jumping up, going, yes, 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 and she's excited. And he said, but you were wrong.
Yeah.
And that, again, shows that difference between them. For him, study is about being right. And for her, it's about finding out the truth. Right?
Getting information, yes.
Getting actual information. And yeah. I loved that. Yeah. And so that was...
Be happy to be wrong. Yeah.
Awesome. Be happy to be wrong. Plus, I also liked it because when they backed up and you saw them walking on that tiny little fragile ship, it reminded me, because I'd just been watching people walking around on their spaceship looking exactly the same because it's an inertial reference frame. And just so she's only barely scratching the surface. She doesn't even understand what she's studying at all. But it's all happening right there. So I love that. I had to keep telling myself, she knows nothing.
Right.
She knows nothing. She doesn't understand about gravity being a property of space and mass is affected by it when it's there. And that, you know, they know absolutely nothing. And
yeah,
and
you have to consider her perspective.
You have to consider. I know. It's great. I love that. And it's a great thing. So it's like at that time, she's like a kid that's coming into physics and think things work in a certain way. It's like they all think what gravity is, but they don't really know what gravity is, and your feet don't need to be at the center.
But at least she admits at the very beginning of the film that she doesn't know what gravity is or why it works the way it works, and that none of her students do either.
Yeah.
And she's trying to get them to think about the larger forces at work.
Yeah. It was a beautiful scene, but do you think, but it was also mixed, because like you said, she's saying, I think that Cyril was talking straight to you because of me. Then she goes off and does her experiment. So what does that actually tell us? It's reinforcing that, yes, she gets all this stuff. She sees the politics, but she's still very focused on what's really important to her, which is figuring out these mysteries of how things work, which is so cool.
When we look at the next scene, there's the mapping out of the night sky. Now, quick note about the filmmakers. The filmmakers apparently are huge nerds, too, and decided that they wanted a completely accurate night sky for the time of year and the year in history. So they actually created some sort of software to help them figure out what the night sky would have looked like, so that in all of the scenes where she's looking at the sky, it is correct.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I was really impressed by that. They're mapping out the night sky. And so we have cuts between Hypatia and Davis. Hypatia is considering it scientifically. Meanwhile, Davis is looking at the sky as Christians debate whether the Earth is flat, whether the Earth is a chest, or whether it is round. They turn to Davis and say, oh, you know the answer. And Davis is like, only God knows these things. Meanwhile, Hypatia is with her slave Aspasius, puzzling over the epicycles and the solar system in general. You know,
although I would take issue with calling it debating if the response is only God knows such things.
Well, I mean,
he was dumbing himself down to be part of that group.
Yeah, I thought that was true too.
He literally had to dumb himself down. He definitely has an idea. He built a model.
Yeah.
Right.
But that's just showing that. He has to dumb himself down. I mean, and I I think that's a slippery slope. I mean, we have flat earthers today, guys.
Yeah.
I mean, and this was, what, 390 AD?
Mm-hmm.
And we still have Christians talking about flat earth? So, I mean...
I guess I think I've deluded myself into thinking that they know that they're wrong and they're just doing it to be difficult. But if they... Right? I mean, you know, they're copping
an
attitude.
Okay. Yeah.
This was actually where I wrote down my bet about you can only change perspective by asking questions, right? Mm-hmm. So here, these guys were actually, I think the other Christians on the steps with Davis were actually kind of talking about it because they said, oh, if it's round, then why do the people on the sides and the bottom not fall off? Once again, not understanding about gravity at all. And so they were actually asking questions. He knew some answers, but as you said, he had to hide his knowledge. So he cut them off by saying only God knows such things. And that's classic. It's like thinking leads to growth, which leads to questioning. And that's never good with religion. Most don't want that. But then Hypatia and Aspasius, them asking questions. So what if this? What if that? And mm-hmm. Oh, maybe it's this. And so the two simultaneous question and answer sessions, but one that just cut it right off, and the other that started leading towards figuring out the orbit.
So then in the next scene, we get the Parabolani, and the Jews trap them inside these gates to stone them. And Cyril is outraged. He basically comes up with all of the tenets of anti-Semitism ever.
Yeah, yeah.
And says, you know, Jews condemned Jesus. They are to be cursed and exiled.
He proposes this
Christian purge of Jews in the streets, which immediately goes on. Davis and Hypatia glimpse each other in the fray as all of this is going on. And then Hypatia comes to Orestes in his chamber and asks, where are the troops? And he says, there's just no hope of containing this frenzy. Cyril wants genocide, and Hypatia says, if you do nothing, no one will be left. So, thoughts on this, lovely?
And of course he doesn't listen.
So. Yeah.
No, of course not. Of course not. Because what is it? They say, I think it's before they're alone, but they say that if we do anything, then half the city will rise up. But it was actually more than that. And it was because there were so many more Christians,
mm-hmm.
and they just didn't expect that. When the Christians had gone into the dance thing and killed Jews, that was fine. You know, they didn't really do anything about that. But then and it looked like a relatively similar number of people,
right?
And they kill that, but that of course is just terrible, and they're mm-hmm. going to not do anything about that. And
this
and
insult
let get away with
cannot
it.
Stand.
This insult, yeah, and all of a sudden, and right under that, I just wrote equals politics and put a box around it. So they were being political. They said, well, if we do that, they have a lot of power, and they're going to be against us, and it's going to be really difficult. And the emperor really likes them now. And I was incensed. I spent a lot of time very angry while watching this.
Maria, were you angry while watching this too?
No.
Or just sad?
Just sad. Mm. Just sad. Because I'm still here, and I mean, you know, I'm still in my window, and just it's there's too many parallels to today.
Yeah.
There's just too many parallels to today, and I mean, this is supposed to be a historical, but it's something that could be filmed today.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Change the names.
Because even one thing I wrote down, if we keep letting Cyril do it, he will just do it again and again. If they can get away with it, then they will. And then that's when you have the people that do know better letting them get away with it. And that's those in a way, that's definitely the people who are more responsible are the ones that do know better, letting the people that don't know better get away with it. Yeah. We keep perpetuating because those of us that just don't get it, it's like the lag time. We have emotional and intellectual lag. And you're like, this is happening? Is this really happening? And then by the time you're questioning whether it's real or not, it's over. I was watching another movie. I ended up watching that because when you first said Rachel Weisz, and I thought you said Diane, and I ended up watching another movie, and someone says in it, if Jesus saw what people did in his name today, he couldn't stop throwing up. Mm-hmm. So, it's true. And I think that would go right back to the very beginning. I honestly believe, just a nice guy saying good things that then become twisted because people want to be right. They can't just believe in their own hearts and behave in a way that mirrors those tenets and the things that Jesus had said. They have to be right with a capital everything. And that's what's wrong. But that was Hypatia's strength, as we said, was that she was always willing and wanting to question her own belief to find something better.
Yeah.
And then all these other people were looking for the one true, looking for a truth that they could
hold on to. Yeah. Maria, what were you thinking?
The truth's not going to become self-evident here if you don't question. In a way, you want to promote, we're teachers, we want to promote education, but it's promoting questioning is even more important.
Yeah.
And questioning and getting multiple answers, and you have to think for yourself. And even though some were questioning, they also would take the first answer that was put in front of them. Yeah. As that's correct. Oh, okay. And it gets disheartening, but I don't want to get depressed. We're looking for bright sides here.
No, I know.
I mean, banana and fig. That was
the banana and the fig, man. Synesius, who was another of Hypatia's students, who is now the Bishop of Cyrene, coming in on horseback into the Agora, he visits Hypatia, who says she's teaching children in her small replica of the library at home, and Orestes shows up. So clearly she's arranged for the two of them to orchestrate peace on some level. And we see Cyril hearing people talking about how there are two Christians in the hands of a heathen. Then we have the Parabolani burning bodies. And Davis asks Ammonius, do you think we're mistaken? I was forgiven, and now I can't forgive. And this is the part where I think he's talking about Hypatia. You guys can disagree with me in a minute. And Ammonius says back to him, God just wants us here doing what we do, or we would have died, obviously. So the fact that you're alive means that God wants you here, which is unfortunately can be used to justify a lot of horrible things. Well, first of all, how did you guys feel about the fact that she's now described as teaching children?
The people that are older are no longer interested in learning anything.
Yeah,
is what that said to me. So it's the classic thing of just give me the kids. And I saw that in a way when I saw it, I actually saw how teaching was downgraded as, mm-hmm. So it instead of automatically being intense discourse between intellectuals, it became just the basics to keep kids occupied and off the streets.
Mm-hmm.
Synesius, the guy who becomes bishop.
Yeah.
He was the first student. He was the first student who questioned in the movie.
Yeah.
Even before Orestes was. So I really was struck by how devout he was of a Christian and how quickly he gave up on Hypatia. So I was surprised by that. So she obviously didn't open his mind as much as I had hoped.
Well, I mean, I think the fact that it's implied that he was a Christian before he started going to her lessons, that implication tells me that he was always trying to fit in the knowledge that he was getting from her into a pre-existing worldview, and that only certain things were filtering in.
If the discussion corroborates what I already believe, then that's fine.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, that was the way I read that.
Yeah, because he was the one that said the, if you criticize creation, you criticize my God, right?
Yeah.
Which led to the whole equality syllogism situation. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was, No, he was intense. He had gone, then he came back. And it was a big switch, but he was more on the side of total faith, Christianity, much more than Orestes was.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because even the other members, not of the Senate, but of the council there, they were like, it's just a matter of time. Just get baptized. Just, you know, they were just taking it as something to do, like pay your dues or you know.
Yeah.
And of course, he was like a zealot. He was what do you believe? You got to believe.
And then you have Hypatia right there who says in that very next scene, do you really think it's just a matter of time before I accept your faith? No, I believe in philosophy, so...
Because he knew
that's what
meant.
We need in these times.
Yeah,
it is. So, your face.
Mm. Once again, just mirroring what's going on today. Mm.
And then we have Orestes and Hypatia yet again. And she's looking up at the sky again and musing on her life, and she's saying how she has no life of her own. But then she goes on to say, I've never loved anyone except my dog. And then Orestes is clearly about to try to, you know, make some moves on her, the glass of wine. And she immediately goes into talking about how the earth is moving and really being more concerned with celestial bodies than anything he's thinking about with bodies. And he brings up death, horror, and destruction. Mm-hmm. And why would the stars share their perfection with us? Which causes her to rethink absolutely everything. It's another shape, and she has this exciting new energy, and she's, you know, all over the place. She's really engaged with thought again, and he's like, oh, whatever, I'm out.
Yeah, that's when she says the purity of the circle has blinded us from seeing anything beyond it. Yeah, and that was it. He just walked away. He was expecting a confession of love. And if only I could
obviously put in the time.
He has. I will give him that. Yeah. I will give him that. But unfortunately, in this instance, it's like, love me and live. Don't love me, you're going to die. You know, so it's
right.
She
just wants the answer. She just wants the answer. Something.
She wants to get to the place where she can die happy. Yeah. Is all that she wants. Yeah.
And as depicted in this film, I really love that at no point is there anything Hollywood about their relationship.
Yeah.
That she never buys what he's selling. He is always frustrated by the way that she treats him, but he still always comes back to saying that she is the woman he most trusts and admires. Yeah. Which I don't know
is
entirely
much,
realistic,
right?
But...
So he clearly does respect her because she was his teacher, but he just can't embrace the purity of her love of science, and that it supplants the need to love a man or anyone besides her dog.
Yeah.
And that just is so alien to him. that he's like, okay, I get it. I'm done. And I love how even perspective, because when they do that and she goes in to get, they have that conversation. She gets all excited, goes in to get the toy that she played with the kids, right? Because mm-hmm. that makes that connection, teaching yeah. them about shapes. Still looks like a circle until they do the tilt. And then you see that it's an ellipse.
Yeah.
And that was cool too.
I too am like you. I was like, thank goodness it wasn't what you normally see, that the woman finally breaks down and falls into his arms, you know, that she was completely distracted by a new idea. Mm-hmm. So I was happy with, I was completely happy that she blew him off.
Yeah.
But she's clueless, because I really don't think she knew the decision she was making.
Yeah. And then, of course, we get into the next scene where Orestes is going to the Sunday service to meet with Cyril, who, of course, has sneakily decided to make everybody listen to his lovely gospel, saying that...
It was a letter.
Yeah,
letter. Which, we read a letter.
One of Paul's wonderful letters.
Yeah, Paul, is it Paul to the Ephesians or the Corinthians?
So. Corinthians is more kind.
Yeah. Ephesians I would guess it's the Ephesians. So,
I think it is.
Saying not to teach or to have authority over a man, that women cannot adorn themselves in any way. And should be subservient in all things. Jesus entrusted his legacy to 12 men, just men, mm-hmm. and therefore...
should be seen as a witch, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
Hypatia declared her ungodliness in public. She's a witch. Cyril says, you must kneel before the word of God now, and everybody slowly kneels... except Orestes, who absolutely refuses. And the mob is mad at him for not kneeling before the book. Ammonius gets out his stones. Davis tries to stop him, but Ammonius hits him in the head anyway. Hypatia is told that she is confined to her home. Thoughts?
She doesn't seem crazily surprised, though, when they tell her that.
No.
She doesn't... which is kind of out of character, but I don't know. She doesn't seem surprised.
Well, given that they already had that conversation about how she should be baptized and so forth, I assume she wouldn't be surprised by the charge of ungodliness, given that she basically admitted to being an atheist in the chamber.
And it wasn't going to change, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, because she'd figured out her problem, right? So when all that happened, she just said, I'm going to go for a walk and I don't need guards.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so I think she did realize exactly what it meant, and she was just done.
Yeah. Yeah.
Most people read her behavior historically to be an act of martyrdom, that she very deliberately chose to go out in public knowing what was going to happen.
Yeah.
And we'll talk more about that in a minute.
Boy, that's so Jesus-like.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, it's that's like a whole other conversation.
I'm just saying.
She's just throwing it out there.
If we want to come full circle.
Great. Right. Yeah. Well, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Check
mm-hmm.
you out with your circles. Circles within circles.
Circles within circles.
So then we have Ammonius, who's been executed, and Orestes is getting stitches, and then his friend Synesius arrives, and as we talked about before, they have this conversation where Synesius says to Orestes, dude, I'm on your side, but I want to know, like, do you believe, like, for realsies? And
if only he had actually said that.
Yeah, if only he actually said for realsies.
That would have been great for realsies. Yeah. Oh,
and then Orestes is like, I couldn't condemn Hypatia. And Synesius is like, well, how many women do you obey, admire, and listen to? And Orestes has to admit there's just one.
And therefore it must be witchcraft.
Right. Which isn't that lovely coming from one of her former students. So then we have Cyril at Ammonius's funeral, who, of course, immediately sanctifies him as Saint Timotheus. The mob wants justice for his death and says, let's hurt him where it hurts most. Hypatia, meanwhile, is having a revelation about the shape of the ellipse. And then we have Davis at the destroyed library among the sheep and the birds in cages. Hypatia watches the sunrise, and Davis is also watching the sunrise and throwing down the rocks and the sword. And he's off running to try to save the day because he knows what's coming for Hypatia. So
he gives up the Parabolani. He gives that up.
Yeah.
Right at the end, and too little, too late, you know?
Yeah.
Too little, too late. So.
Well, everybody is too little, too late. I mean, in the next part, she's with Orestes, and he's saying, all dignitaries must be baptized. I want you to be baptized. You are the person I trust most. I need you to defeat Cyril. And she's like, dude, Cyril has already won.
Yeah.
And she recognizes that it's all too little, too late.
Mm-hmm.
And that because the men around her weren't paying attention to the things she said before, you know, she's going to die. And she'd rather die than play the game.
Than play the game and be around what's going to be going on.
Yeah, this was a depressing movie. Yeah.
Yes. Thank you.
No light in sight here. There's no light part to it, and it just gets a little darker, doesn't it? Just keeps getting darker. So.
It does. Although, I actually like certain aspects of the ending, and you will too when you know what the real historical ending is.
Okay.
But
let's do it. More to that.
Yeah. So she sneaks out. The guards are told she doesn't need them. Davis is called back because they found Hypatia. The Parabolani capture her, take her to the library, strip her naked. And first they say, let's skin her alive. Davis says, don't stain your hands with impure blood. Let's just stone her. And then Davis holds her in sort of a loving embrace. And then he kills her. He smothers her to death so that she won't feel the stones. And the others are off gathering stones. When they come back, he says she fainted. And they're all gathered, throwing stones at her dead body. And the camera moves up to the oculus, the circle looking at the sky. And after this, we get the crawl about what the upshot is of the movie. Hypatia's body was dragged through the streets and burnt. Orestes was never seen again. Cyril seized control of Alexandria and was sainted. None of Hypatia's work survived, but she was known for her excellence in astronomy and mathematical studies. All right, here's where we play the game of what do you think was accurate?
The fact that none of her work survived.
Well, that's a pretty fair bet, yeah.
I went for the low-hanging fruit.
Yeah. Question, how old do you think Hypatia was when she died?
I would think very old.
How old 50s. Is very old?
I would think 50s.
I think she was much older than what they showed in the movie.
That she died probably in her late 40s.
Late 40s.
Yeah. So A lot of the events with Orestes, as described, happen when she's in her 20s, actually, which she would have been an old maid in her 20s.
Just she would have been an clear. Old maid at 16, probably, yeah. right?
No, yeah. no so. Seriously, at age yeah. 12 is where normally she would have been married off.
Right.
And the fact that her father didn't marry her off is a somewhat extraordinary thing. So based on the Hypatia biography by Edward Watts, in the spring of 415, Cyril was in fact the Bishop of Alexandria. Cyril summoned a mob of monks trying to intimidate Orestes, the governor, who was in fact in love with Hypatia. We don't know exactly how many times he tried to seduce her, but he definitely had public declarations and was publicly known to be a student of hers, as well as highly influenced by her. One of the mob hurled a stone at Orestes. Orestes had him arrested, tortured, and killed. Cyril then blamed those problems on Hypatia, who was the foremost thinker for 35 years in Alexandria. And the Christians saw Hypatia as a witch. They believed that she blocked Cyril from all the important political conversations that mattered in Alexandria at the time. So there was this belief on the part of Christians that she was the reason that Orestes was not following their dictates. And so Peter, who was a supporter of Cyril, confronts Hypatia with the mob as he finds her teaching in public. They grab her, shred her clothes and her body with pottery fragments, tear out her eyes, and drag her corpse through the streets and burn her remains. So that last part in the crawl is correct, but it's a much more gruesome ending for her.
So why did they feel... See, now this just gets me upset. So the filmmakers want us to think that she's frail and we have to protect her from that kind of a death?
Well, I don't know that that's true. I think
perpetuating
it's more
the love
that...
interest of Davis? What?
I think it's more that they want to bring a conclusion to the character of Davis. I mean, there's absolutely no historical basis for the character of Davis. They're just using him as an additional lens for showing the transition between things.
You can get sucked into being a Christian and realize it's full of crap.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I mean, that's what Davis's role was.
Yeah.
Right. Well, get sucked into being the belligerent version, whereas he had the unofficial, actual traits of what a Christian should have been had it not become a political machine.
He was a better guy before he even picked a religion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was just a better guy when he said, beat me instead of the slave who was a Christian. He was like, you know... So, and then as soon as he got involved in religion, Davis did nothing good, murder, kill, and everything. And then as soon as he realizes, hey, I've got to leave all this behind, and that epiphany comes true. So Davis had an important, huge role in the film of showing, I believe, the filmmaker's view that religion is stupid.
Yeah. But then also granting a certain peace to the ending. I mean, if you're going to have such a depressing ending where your heroine, who you've been following for 2 hours, who you identify with, if you have a character who knows everything, all sides of everything from the film, step in to protect her and kill her, and keep her from feeling pain at the end, that's certainly better than having her eyes plucked out, which I don't think anyone actually wants to see on film.
No.
No, well.
I tend to get a little defensive when I see someone that was supposed to have been a strong woman being given an out. But it was told it was because of his love for her. Wow, that's so messed up because his love for her got her in trouble too.
Yeah. Well, everyone's love for her got her in trouble.
Yeah.
So again, being a sex object.
Yeah.
Is never a good thing for a woman. Historically, her death has a lot of ramifications because this is the first time that elites suddenly realize that they are vulnerable to mobs. Even people who are considered prominent realize that mob control is absolute at this point. And
were there any political repercussions for her death at the time that you know of?
Well, I mean, Orestes is actually forced into exile, basically, at this point. His career ends. She becomes known as sort of a martyr. She's a symbol of rationality versus religious fundamentalism. The main thing that happens, though, as a result of her death, is that Cyril really just grabs control absolutely. But the people who value Hypatia still value her very strongly. And she is one of the only examples that people can think of when you ask them who are the great pagan martyrs rather than the Christian martyrs. That's another thing the film gets wrong. She says, "I believe in philosophy." And while that's true, she's not actually an atheist. She is a pagan. Mm. She does worship the gods as far as we know.
Because to portray her as a philosopher, a thinker, a scientist, and praying to a biscuit god,
yeah,
you know, is dichotomous. So, right. And that's too hard for people to wrap their heads around.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, they played into the stereotypes throughout the movie.
Yeah,
that's one of the stereotypes they just continued to use. But kind of like that we're atheists. I'm not an atheist.
Yeah.
I think science makes me have more faith.
Why do you think that?
Because, oh my God, it's just so cool.
Mm-hmm.
It's just so cool.
That nature's perfection is a reflection of that.
It's just so cool. Yeah. It's infinite.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, really, just mathematics itself is so freaking cool and infinite. And maybe I have no answers. I have no religious associations. But
it can go one way or the other. For me, it's just so cool that that's just enough for me.
Yeah, so, it's just so cool. Yeah.
So for me, the math and the way things fit together, you know, it does make you scratch your head ever so slightly that when you look closer inside atomic structures, things resemble things on the outside, planets and orbitals,
right.
Orbits and orbitals, right? And the similarities. But for me, the very fact that those things do reflect each other, that's plenty. So science and nature is for me what other people call a god and a religion. So it's enough for me. It's enough for it to be beautiful. I don't need it to have meaning. I'll know soon enough.
I minored in religion and immunology, biology. But yeah, it was one of my minors, religions of the Eastern world. And you'll find that there's just weird leaps of faith, whether the universe was ejaculated by a turtle or, I mean, there's just so many different religions and beliefs, but hatred and bigotry run through all of them.
Yeah.
Right.
General thoughts about this movie.
I'm going to agree with Ellen. If it was not an assignment, I don't know I would have made it through.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I'm glad I did.
Okay.
Yes. I'll give it that.
Glad I did. Just as a movie in general, it could have moved faster.
Mm-hmm.
It could have moved faster. And perspective and social commentary. They were putting a lot of stuff into this movie.
They did.
So I can understand why it took so long.
Yeah. And I went back, I watched it the first time, and then I went back today and went through to take notes on it. And there definitely were, I mean, I think I would have edited more if I were to, I would have definitely. But once I got into it, I was enjoying it more, right? I was definitely following through and I was fascinated. I just wanted more of the science stuff and less of the religious overtones, but it was a true story. It's historical. Therefore it had to have all that in it. But it was, couldn't quite figure out if it was being historical or not. So that it's like, it didn't really pick. And, but I enjoyed it when it was done. I was glad I watched it because I got a lot of stuff out of it, but I do have trouble with, it's like, I never watched Titanic more than once. I mean, I know how it ends and I know what happens. And so this one was tough too. And I didn't, I mean, I got through the bits and then I'm like, okay, the rest of it is just all that. And I'm not watching that. So I just I couldn't go back and watch that again. Although, and I wonder though, now knowing that the actual end of her life was different from the end in the movie, I wonder if I would have been more, because that bothered me. I mean, it was a kindness that he did, but that's what made it so schmaltzy for me at the end. And I didn't want the schmaltz. I wanted it to continue to be a movie about a tough scientist woman that lived her life independently for the pursuit of that, and she hadn't been coddled or protected before that, really, except by her station in life. And then for that to be, so that ending was a little bit disappointing for me, not because of the brutality of it, but because of the softness. I know we discussed that and you're right. You definitely brought me around to see that was important for the overall statement and the fair look at Davis's religious experience. But as a movie, I think I'm going to have to give it like a 6.5.
Okay.
And that's out of 10.
And that's out of 10 with moments. Like if I were going to look at just that boat scene, the boat scene was a 10, right? Okay. The boat scene was an absolute 10. Whenever she was there, when she was with the asparagus.
I've got Aspasias.
Aspasias. Okay. That's what I wrote down last time. When she was with Aspasias, those scenes were great. When the give and take and that, when they were doing those bits, that was great. And it was just that there was so much of that other stuff that just gets me angry. It just made me angry with men and angry with organized religion. And so that was my thing. And I don't like feeling angry.
Right.
So that bothered me. But the rest of it was very good as far as the love, her intense love of science and truth. Those parts were beautiful. But it was, and it's classic though, because the two stories going on at the same time, her life of intellect, which was great, and then the world absolutely falling into darkness around her and she's at the center, and then just the candle goes out and she's gone, and there we are. And then they point out 1200 years later, people finally get their act together and rediscover some of this stuff that had been building up.
And they're still fighting.
And still.
Yeah. So the calm comes and then, okay, now let's fight with this group. And then the calm comes and then let's fight with this group. And then the calm. And cities rise and fall and ours will do the same.
Yep.
It's so true.
Yep.
Until we change. I think 6.5, I was going to go 6. So I wasn't even going to.
I threw in the 0.5 right at the end. I did. I threw that in right at the end there. But yeah, I was thinking.
Yeah, it got as high. Yeah, it got parts got high and obviously the banana fig was a 10 for me.
The thing was great.
We know the part Maria loved best.
Yeah.
But, yeah, and the bloody scarf was probably down around a
That took it down to like a 2 for me. 3, okay. That's good. Okay. But I didn't. But again, there's some basis of truth in it, but still. And then there were places.
But we don't know the actual context.
But we don't know the actual context. And
I feel like without context, that anecdote is almost meaningless. Because I wrote down in my notes that, you know.
As teachers, I think we should all agree that things that we do and demonstrations that we give, not that we've ever done that for a demonstration,
right, no,
can be taken out of context.
Yeah, and, for sure.
Yes, they can. Yes, and, they can.
Yeah, right.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
I made a fantastic point at the time.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Yeah.
But who knows?
Thousands of years later.
She might have had a truly sick burn that went along with that.
Right.
Right.
That's true.
Right?
And no dude actually wrote it down.
I really loved the boat scene. That was good. When she was gleeful and hopping up and down with delight because of that. That was good. And then the die happy and then die the next day. But clearly there's plenty to talk about. So there was lot of stuff in there. There was a lot of stuff in there. But it really just did, for me, underscore just how much harm can be done and has been done in the name of religion. I'm not saying religion causes it. I'm saying that it's what people do in the name of.
Yes.
Because they're using it as an excuse to maintain control and power. And that's... To me, you know, I just think, it sounds funny with the person who says atheist, and it's because I am such a complete atheist that there could be hell. There could be anything. I have no idea. So, and I would want them. When I think about the horrible people that misuse positions of power, belief, and faith for their own purposes, that's when I want there to be a hell so that there can be a very special thing that happens to them when they get there, you know? So it's like all the people that they deluded now get to do something to them, because it's the worst to take people and say, this is what you do to be a good person, and then have them do horrible things. That is the worst. I've seen what it could do. And I know what you can do when you lead people by encouraging them and telling them to go out there and make the world a better place. And nowhere in making the world a better place do you go saying that you're absolutely right all the time. So those two things, true altruism and being right all the time, do not go together. They are dichotomous. So there. That's okay. My problem. Yeah. So if that's vindictive, then so be it.
Own it.
I'm going to work it. But at the same time, trying to leave the place better than I found it. That's all I can do.
All right.
Through podcasts like this. This was great. This was actually a lot of fun.
This was a lot of fun.
Yes.
So thank you so much, Ellen and Maria, for your perspective.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Ariel. Yeah,
this was great. Thank you so much to Ellen and Maria for coming on this week to talk about Agora and Hypatia of Alexandria. I look forward to seeing you guys again next week when we'll be discussing the Amazon sci-fi series, Tales from the Loop. In the meantime, I would encourage our listeners to consider hitting subscribe to our podcast wherever you listen. We are still a fledgling podcast, so I understand if you don't feel comfortable rating or reviewing yet, but any help you can give us is greatly appreciated. And I want to say thank you so much for listening, and we look forward to having you on the Omnibus again.